Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week, Republicans in Washington will try to regain their footing after some bruising political setbacks last week. Leading the charge, President Bush, beginning an 8-day swing through Asia, is once again expected to push back hard against critics who claim his top aides misused intelligence to justify the war in Iraq. White House National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley spoke about those critics on CNN's Late Edition last night.
We need to put this debate behind us. It's unfair to the country. It's unfair to the men and women in uniform risking their lives to make this country safe.
Meanwhile, in Congress, moderate and conservative Republicans will try to pass a budget after failing last week to agree on how much to cut social programs and taxes. We'll speak with leading Republican moderate Congressman Charlie Bass of New Hampshire in a moment. But first, on the line from Washington, Dana Milbank, national political reporter for The Washington Post. And Dana, what's your assessment of the ability of Republicans at this time to push the party agenda?
Well, Robin, obviously we're at a low point in terms of the party discipline after 5 years of extraordinary discipline. You have the president's weakening poll numbers. You have Tom DeLay losing his House leadership position over the indictment. And you have a lot of moderates like Charlie Bass finally saying, we're going to go our own way. We're going to do what's important for our constituents. They're not intimidated by the Republican leadership. They're not intimidated by President Bush anymore. Now, there aren't a lot of them out there, but there are enough of them to put an end to a lot of the elements of the leadership's agenda, and that includes certain tax cuts, that includes certain budget cuts, and it could extend a very long way.
Well, still, maybe they've lost their footing, but the White House is striking back, going on the offensive to the joy of many in the party base. And let's address some of the points the president and Stephen Hadley are making, two in particular. One, claiming that Democrats saw the same intelligence before the war and then voted to support the invasion of Iraq. Is that assessment accurate?
Well, the overall claim that the intelligence did indicate that Iraq had the weapons of mass destruction, that is true. That is clearly what the intelligence indicated. Now, that does not answer the question of whether the administration took the intelligence and then exaggerated certain things and downplayed others, and that's what the Democrats are asking about.
In fact, many, right now. I'm thinking John Kerry last week said that, in fact, they didn't see all the intelligence, that the intelligence went through the White House first. And so, for instance, CIA criticism of the assessment that Iraq was looking for weapons of mass destruction wasn't included in much of the intelligence that Democrats saw.
Well, certainly nobody of either party in the Congress saw as much as the administration saw. They don't see the president's daily briefs, the national intelligence estimate, which was a summary itself. They got just a few days before the debate, and they weren't allowed to mention certain elements of this, the doubts particularly, in public on the floor of the Senate. Now, we don't know exactly what intelligence the White House had and what intelligence Congress has, but what Congress has is obviously some smaller subset of what the White House said. So that part is accurate, Mr. Hadley and the president are not correct to say it was the same intelligence. Mm-hmm. It may have been similar, but it wasn't the same.
Well, are Democrats, by the way, also saying that in fact, whatever we saw, we now know much of the intelligence was flawed or forged?
Certainly they're saying it was flawed, and the administration no longer disputes that notion at all. It's merely a question of if the Congress had all of the same intelligence that the president was entitled to, would they have come to a different conclusion? Now, my colleagues were told when they looked into this a year ago, only six members of Congress actually read the entire national intelligence estimate, all of 92 pages of it. The caveats were in there, so if they wanted to go look for them, they certainly could have found them.
As to the criticism that the White House aides manipulated intelligence, both the president and Stephen Hadley saying these people who have looked at that issue on the Hill in Congress and also in several commissions have concluded it did not happen. Is that accurate?
No, it's not. They seem to be conflating two things here. The commissions did say that they didn't find any. The Senate commission, an independent commission that the president set up, did say they didn't see the White House putting influence on intelligence analysts to change their judgments. But that question is separate and apart from the question of did the White House take the intelligence and then exaggerate it after the fact. So they're conflating those two issues. And that second question has really never been answered, and that's what the Democrats are pushing for the Senate Intelligence Committee to investigate now.
In fact, the bipartisan group of senators who are beginning an investigation into how the administration used intelligence before the war is expected to come out with a progress report today. What do you expect?
Not much progress. This group of six sort of gave up on the task, tossed it to the overall committee. The Republicans are still saying, look, we have always been investigating this. It's possible the Republicans will just go ahead with their version of an investigation and the Democrats will just holler about it.
And we spoke when we began about the battles between Republican moderates and conservatives in Congress over the budget and other things. Who do you think is going to win the budget fight?
Well, the budget fights always tend to end in one direction, and that is more spending. That's one thing all parties can agree on here. The leadership is still fighting. They're fighting to save a tax cut in the Senate. They're fighting to save budget cuts in the House. It's going to be very difficult to get anything through. Generally, what happens is you get some symbolic victory, but a very small amount, and the budget deficit continues to increase.
Dana Milbank, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Dana, thank you. And joining us now from his home in New Hampshire is Congressman Charles Bass, one of the leaders of the moderate wing of the Republican Party. He's against those tax cuts and big cuts in programs like food stamps. Congressman Bass, thanks so much for your time. Welcome.
Thank you. It's very good to be here. Let me make a couple corrections.
Please.
Moderates rarely agree on much of anything, and in my particular instance, I've never disagreed with the proposal to reduce the growth of entitlements, and I believe that some tax relief is always necessary, especially given that some of these provisions that we passed, which I voted for two or three years ago, will expire this year. What I don't think we need to see right now is tax relief provisions enacted that don't expire for two or three or four years from now, because obviously with Hurricane Katrina and Iraq and other issues, we've got enormous deficits to deal with, and deficits are very important. One other little quick item. Dana mentioned earlier about flawed intelligence is not forged. I served on the Intelligence Committee for 5 years. The intelligence was there. It was understandable. There were dissenting opinions and so forth. And maybe our own leadership, which gets these briefings every day, should have been more aggressive. But it's generally concluded, not only within the United States but internationally, that the information that we used to go into Iraq was considered to be accurate. The debate was whether or not we should have done it as quickly and as aggressively as we did.
But just to put that topic aside, as we've been hearing in the last couple of months, there are some who would say that the intelligence was not only flawed but forged. And as you well know, that's been part of that debate. But I want to stick
there's
with
no forgery in the intelligence. That's a bogus charge.
I'm talking about the intelligence that led to a claim that Iraq was getting yellow cake from Niger.
That was not forged. There is no such thing as truth or untruth in intelligence. It's how you interpret and analyze the information, what the conclusions are that you come to. And obviously there were some errors there, but it wasn't forged. Forgery means that there were people conspiring to deceive the President of the United States. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Well, I do want to talk about the budget, but, okay. You know, we're hearing about a freelance Italian spy who might have been shopping this intelligence around, and that's where the thinking comes that was a forgery.
Well, intelligence is graded, and maybe there was an issue in terms of its grade, i.e. how reliable it was. That happens all the time, but if you define forgery, that means that there was somebody with criminal intent who was either in a position of responsibility or power. Now, we do have people that provide bad intelligence. They're not usually on our side, though.
Oh, well, that, of course, and that's I think we're agreeing on that. Okay. But to the budget, because I'm not surprised that you jumped in to clarify your position after hearing from Dana Milbank. As we heard, he's saying that there is a perception that the moderate Republicans are the ones who are the spenders. You know, as the deficit continues to rise, in other words, the other Republicans are fiscally responsible. You object to that.
I think that's a little bit dogmatic. What's mm-hmm. really at work here is that there's some moderates that have specific issues with some of the particular reductions that are anticipated in the growth of Medicare, and I mean in growth of entitlements, and I understand that. But for the most part, the moderates are in favor. They understand that entitlement, the growth of entitlements, need to be curbed, and they want to make sure that it's done fairly, and that we don't cast votes that we don't need to cast because of what the Senate has done. Some moderates believe that we ought to just accept the Senate plan and make some changes within it, but overall, just accept that. There's another issue, and that's the question of drilling in the Arctic mm-hmm. Wilderness. And I have felt, along with a large majority of the moderates, that that's an extraneous issue that doesn't belong in the budget because it can't pass the Senate. That's no reason to put it into reconciliation or our budget documents. And so I'm pleased to say that that's out. Now we have to figure out how we can compromise. This is a tough vote, and come up with a plan that isn't just a tiny little change, but is really something significant, because Republicans and Democrats agree that we do need to curb the growth of government. Frank, unfortunately, there isn't a single Democrat at present who's willing to really legislate on the basis of making policy rather than politics.
Well, Congressman Bass,
that makes it a lot harder.
But Congressman Bass, to the infighting among the Republicans, mm-hmm. as you know, this has been an extraordinarily disciplined party. I'm thinking of the fight over the new Medicare prescription drug benefit and the arm twisting that went on then. What's changed now? What has happened to embolden the moderates?
Well, first of all, bear in mind that the moderates got a landmark stem cell bill through the Congress earlier with the help of 25 other Republicans mm-hmm. who didn't consider themselves to be moderates, and I would consider that to be a significant victory. But getting to your point, I think that obviously with the party's fortunes down, with a message clearly that most Americans would rather see a more moderate form of leadership in the country right now, that it's time to govern from the middle. That doesn't mean we do nothing; just means that we listen a little bit more. And obviously, there are plenty of members of Congress who are concerned about the fact that a lot of their own party, Republicans, are complaining that we seem to be more concerned with the bridge to nowhere in Alaska and earmarks and appropriations than we are about what our fundamental principles are, which is less government, lower taxes, and a strong national security. So people like me, although it's through the moderate agenda, are sending a message to our leadership that we want them to shape up and stop thinking about what they can do for themselves and start thinking about the country and what our agenda is and what our priorities are. Frankly, I've called for new elections in leadership in beginning of next year, so we have a fresh slate of officers outside of the speaker to for the next session of the Congress.
Congressman Charles Bass from New Hampshire, we've got about 30 seconds left. Your critics say that it is all about politics, that re-elections next year, and that's the only reason you guys are stepping out. You would say what?
I would say that there's nothing new. It's part of both. Obviously, it's about elections. If our leadership is out of step, we want to bring them back in step, and that's what we'll do.
Congressman Charles Bass of New Hampshire, a member of the moderate wing of the Republican Party. Congressman Bass, always appreciate speaking with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And he spoke to us from his home in the Granite State. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Jordanians are reacting to the arrest of the woman alleged to be part of the first known husband and wife suicide bombing team. A video that aired last night on Jordanian television shows the 35-year-old Iraqi woman confessing to a failed suicide attempt at the Radisson Hotel last week, saying that while her husband was successful, she was unable to detonate her bomb belt, which was shown wrapped around her waist on the broadcast. 57 people were killed when suicide bombers caused separate blasts at three hotels last Wednesday night. The Iraqi woman would have been the fourth bomber, but questions have arisen as to whether her story holds up. We're joined on the line by Kristen Gillespie. She's a reporter for CBS Radio based in Amman. And Kristen, this woman, Sajida Mubarak al-Rishawi, said her husband saw she was having trouble setting off her bomb and pushed her away to safety. How are people reacting to that story?
People are reacting in different ways. Some people are glad that the bomber was caught before her belt went off. Other people are skeptical that the woman on television really was the bomber. They're thinking that how could the police have put this together so fast? How could the intelligence have tracked her down? Why didn't she kill herself? Why didn't she throw the vest away before? So there's still a lot of questions surrounding this woman. Her statement on television last night was about 3 minutes, so it just was really the tip of the iceberg of what happened here on Wednesday night.
What are Jordanian officials saying about how they were able to track her down?
There was a press conference yesterday with Deputy Prime Minister Marwan Muasher, Jordanian minister here, and reporters pressed him hard on this point. We wanted details. We wanted to know when, where, and how. And really, we didn't get anything. What we did get is that she was captured in a safe house in Amman, and that it was the same house that she, her husband, and the two other bombers had stayed in for 4 days before the bombs.
We know that this woman is reported to be the brother of the top aide to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the terrorist leader who has claimed responsibility for the bombings. He, of course, is the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And we understand that officials have said that that claim by al-Qaeda in Iraq on the internet, that there was a woman involved, helped them find this woman that they claim is that woman.
We really don't know what happened, but I can tell you this. After the Radisson wedding hall was looked at by the intelligence and police, this is where the husband and wife were in the Radisson wedding party, they took everything out of the hotel, and I think it wasn't difficult to see that there had been two bombers. They immediately confiscated the wedding video that had been filmed. There were also surveillance videos from the hotel. I think it wasn't difficult to see that there had been a woman that went in with this man, and the woman's remains hadn't been found. So I think when the statement emerged, I suspect that al-Qaeda in Iraq didn't realize that the woman was still alive. And when the statement came out, perhaps that helped the Jordanians realize who this woman was.
We understand, in fact, that there was a lot of horn honking in celebration when it was announced that this alleged suicide bomber, this woman, had been arrested. But we're reading, too, some analysts saying that that may also have been exactly Zarqawi's intent to cause chaos.
Chaos was definitely caused by these explosions. I have to say, though, that I was at the Hyatt just a few minutes after the bomb exploded there, and the ambulances were coming a dozen a minute, every minute. The police were there. The army was there within minutes. Dozens of police cars. Of course, it was too late. The bomb had already gone off, but certainly the reaction by the Jordanian forces here, emergency services, was formidable.
Well, if in fact al-Qaeda in Iraq was responsible for the attacks, what would that say about a possible shift in strategy for the group?
For al-Qaeda, what it looks like is that Zarqawi is trying to export the instability that exists in Iraq to surrounding countries. This could be for a variety of reasons. Look at all the media attention that's come to Jordan since these explosions happened. These explosions happen almost every day in Baghdad, and you certainly don't see the level, the intensity of coverage. This is a novelty for Jordan. It's never happened before. So if this is a way to give more attention to Zarqawi and his group, he might have succeeded in that respect. However, if he wanted to turn Jordanians' opinion against the monarchy and the ruling family for perhaps their tacit cooperation with the Americans in Iraq, he failed in doing that. Jordanians have taken to the streets for 4 days now, rallying and marching and protesting, all denouncing Zarqawi.
CBS reporter Kristen Gillespie speaking to us from Amman. And Kristen, analysts are saying that al-Zarqawi's goal is to disrupt Jordan, even if it's with protests against him. And today, Neil McFarquhar writes a piece in the New York Times pointing out that many Jordanians are asking why the feared Mukhabarat, the secret police, are spending more time investigating Jordanians than keeping Jordanians safe from outsiders from Iraq.
It's funny because the forces that are shaping Jordanian politics right now are Zarqawi and the President of the United States. George Bush is pressing for democracy, for more openness, for more reform in the Middle East, Zarqawi is pressing for more chaos and ultimately a revolution that will dismantle Arab rulers from their positions that they've held for decades or their fathers have held. So the story today in the New York Times I found refreshing because I've lived here for 3 years, and certainly the Mukhabarat haven't harassed me because I'm a foreign journalist, but it's absolutely a factor in people's daily lives and how they live and work.
Well, given that, we know that Condoleezza Rice is making her way to Jordan. What might she confront? What does she have to address on this trip?
I think the Secretary of State is going to have to look at what Jordan's overall strategy is, and that at this point, the war on terror and reform have to go hand in hand. What happens is Arab rulers generally say, we're trying to fight terror, there's no time for reform, we're in siege mode, we have to just button down the hatches and, you know, we'll talk about reform later on. What I think analysts are saying and people here are saying is we want to breathe, we want to live, we want to express our opinions, why can't we do that? And if they don't do it, then the terrorists are doing it.
Kristen Gillespie, a reporter for CBS Radio. She's speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Kristen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And we have this note. Jordanian authorities now say that one of the suicide bombers whose body has been recovered and DNA tested matches the name of an Iraqi who was detained by American forces in Fallujah last year. U.S. officials say they don't know if the 23-year-old bomber is the same man they had captured and then released, because they had, at that time, no compelling evidence to hold him. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Doctors for Slobodan Milosevic, the 64-year-old former president of Yugoslavia on trial for genocide and crimes against humanity in the former Yugoslavia, are calling for a halt to the trial, saying that Mr. Milosevic is too sick to defend himself. The trial, which has dragged on for 4 years, was scheduled to conclude next year, but most now think that will not happen, leaving Mr. Milosevic's fate in doubt and his accusers frustrated. Milosevic is one of 125 people being prosecuted at The Hague for war crimes in the former Yugoslavia. These trials are creating a body of law that could serve as a guide for future war crimes tribunals worldwide, including the trial of Saddam Hussein, currently being held in Iraq. Carla Dobhante is the chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal. She was in Boston recently, and I talked to her about the trial and the controversial decision to allow Mr. Milosevic to defend himself. Milosevic has a law degree, but has behaved erratically, delaying the trial. And I asked Ms. Del Ponte why Mr. Milosevic was allowed to defend himself in the first place.
It is a principle in international law, particularly, that if the accused is able to defend himself, he must be allowed to do that.
What have some of his tactics been as he defends himself? There have been huge outbursts. He has, on occasion, not called the judge Your Honor. He's called him Mr. But what are some of his actual tactics that are delaying the trial?
Of course, in conducting himself, it takes a lot of time because he put also questions that are not pertinent to the counts of the indictment. And so we lose a lot of time. And, you know, mostly it is a political message for the Serb people who are watching and looking.
And observing that in some cases it looks like he has the upper hand, at least in some of the video coming out of this, and he's taken, 66 sick days? So what is the sense? I mean, ultimately the verdict of The Hague will be the deciding factor, but in the meantime, are the prosecutors perhaps losing the PR battle?
how Milosevic behave in court, it's not our problem. Mm. And you must not forget that each accused must be able to defend himself as he want to do it, because that is the principle of a fair trial. Mm. So we cannot impose a defense strategy to an accused. Each accused choose his defense strategy. Milosevic has chosen this one. It takes time, because 10-year crimes are a lot of evidences that we must present in court.
Well, in fact, now we're seeing the trial of Saddam Hussein, and prosecutors there are taking a different strategy. They're concentrating on just a few key events, not the full range of his alleged atrocities in a 24-year rule. Do you think that they are reacting to the Milosevic case? And, you know, do you think maybe the Milosevic case should have been narrowed?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Because we on our side thought that it was much more useful to have all indictments together, all the crimes committed in Kosovo, Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina at the same time, particularly in view of the fact that we are representing the victims of the crimes.
I was just going to say, we're hearing from Iraqi people that many of them are angry that they're not getting to have their particular, you're shaking your head, they're not getting to have their
exactly.
particular cases addressed.
Exactly. Because in our system, in our trials, the victims are not represented by a lawyer, they are not participating in the trial, and the prosecutor representing the victims. So we thought that all the victims should be represented in the same time.
We're speaking with Carla De Bohante, the chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia. And, you know, as you well know, the two most infamous war crime indictees are still at large. Radovan Karadzic, who was the civilian Serb leader during the Bosnian War, and Ratko Mladic, who is the military Serb leader. They're wanted in part for the 1995 massacre at Srebrenica, which there was just an anniversary of that. Deadlines have been set. You've set a new one for mid-December. Why can't these two men be brought to justice?
You know, they are now, since 1995, at large. And, of course, at the beginning, I have even evidences that Karadzic and Mladic were not arrested because the political will was non-existent.
Well, we understand that the local police chiefs in the areas where they're assumed to be tell them when there's going to be a raid.
Yes, and in 10 years, they learn perfectly how to hide first. So the organization to hide is now improved, is now particularly sophisticated. But despite that, they are considered from most part of the population to be heroes. So we are still struggling and fighting that it should be done. And the last time limit is December now.
And then what?
And then I will in December appear before the Security Council. I will open all my files about the reasons why they were not arrested, because it is different responsibility.
So you'll see that perhaps the international community through the UN can put pressure on the political leaders to do this.
Absolutely, and they must take measures.
Some say, as you well know, the tribunal can't be taken seriously until these two men are brought to justice. Are you saying more troops should go in, more NATO troops? Or
No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that because Mladic is in Serbia and the authority in Serbia are not denying it anymore. Mm. So it is just a question to locate him in time to put in place an operation to arrest him. Karadzic, we don't know where he is, but he's moving for sure from Republika Srpska to Montenegro and Serbia. So it is more a question of coordination between the different authorities, from the different nations, that they are working together to obtain a positive result.
Coordination sounds like a euphemism for really somebody leaning on these Serbian officials to get them to cough up these guys.
Yes.
Yeah. And you know, given the fact that they are still out there,
yeah,
not liking you very much, you've made quite a few enemies in your very admirable track record as prosecutor in different countries. In fact, your home was almost blown up in Italy when you went after the mafia. Mm. There, a good friend of yours was killed, a judge was killed. You've been called a long list of names, the Gestapo, a whore, mm-hmm. by those you were going after in the mafia. We are sitting here now surrounded by security guards as you travel. Do you fear for your life as you go after people like the Serbs who committed those atrocities?
I think not more than you fear for your life. I think each of us are doing his job, it's so many years that I'm a prosecutor, and it is so many years now that I receive threats that I'm not considering. I'm not taking it very seriously, and I'm doing my job. And, you know, what you said is a sign that if you are hurting criminals, you are doing a good job. And that is the satisfaction for me.
Carla Del Ponte, Chief Prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Still to come, Allen Ginsberg's Howl turns 50. You're listening to Here and Now. Ever get cornered at a party by someone who just won't stop talking? Conversely, have you been in an office meeting with someone who won't meet your eyes and wonder, do they hate you? How about the coworker who won't stop talking about how lousy work is? How do you tell her, you're working, you don't have time to talk? Syndicated health columnist Judy Foreman says that what used to be called social situations are now being treated as emotional intelligence challenges, and she's here to explain. Judy, you say this is wildly popular. Remind us, what is emotional intelligence?
Hi.
And you say this is wildly popular, this idea of counseling people about emotional intelligence. What is emotional intelligence again?
Emotional intelligence is kind of an idea that's been around in psychology circles for a long time, but it really got popularized about 10 years ago with Daniel Goleman, who at the time was a New York Times science writer, and he's also a psychologist. And it's basically the idea that you pay attention to your own feelings and have an awareness of what's going on with you, and then you try to also understand what's going on with the other person and behave sensibly and not just get swept away by it all.
Right. It's becoming very popular in business circles.
Absolutely. There's all these training programs that people in various companies hire emotional intelligence experts to teach their staff how to be more sensitive and aware of themselves. And they claim, some of the companies, that this actually translates into a better bottom line.
Well, and we understand, too, from your column that there are school children who have been taught emotional intelligence skills, and apparently they do better?
Yes, they do better. They like school better. There was a big study of about 300 studies on kids in school, and the ones who had emotional intelligence training liked school better, they behaved better in class, and their grade averages went up. So it seems as though it can work to teach people these things.
And we want to be clear, we're not talking here about people who might have a medical syndrome such as Asperger's or autism, who sometimes just can't read emotional signals from other people. They don't know when to let you walk away when they're talking to you.
I'm not talking about that. This is everyday, regular people without those problems, but who still, you know, are difficult to deal with. In fact, there's seminars around the country with titles like Dealing with Difficult People or Dealing with Difficult People, Including Yourself.
Well, let's talk about some of the categories of difficult people.
Okay.
Energy vampires.
Yeah, that's a term by this UCLA psychiatrist, Dr. Judith Orloff, and she has a whole little mini thesis essentially about these people who basically sap your energy, and we've all encountered them.
Or been them.
Or been
yes.
them, right.
But in the case of, for instance, the sob sister, this is a difficult work situation. Someone who complains all the time and wants you to sort of join them on the dark side.
Not just that. They won't even, they just want to complain. They don't want solutions.
Well, and so what do you say to them?
Well, I think you eventually say, as nicely as you can, you know, we've been talking for a few minutes now or a few days now, and every time I offer a solution, you kind of reject it. And I really care about you, but I don't think we're getting anywhere. Or I really love you and I care about you, but I need some time for myself now.
So in these workshops or panel discussions, you would learn some of the skills to sort of build boundaries around yourself.
Yes, and sort of have the self-possession to be aware of your own feelings and reaction, and then translate that into a kind but firm response to the other person.
And some of the situations are, you know, potentially dangerous. I'm thinking of the Sherman tanks. That's how they're identified again by a psychologist at the University of Iowa. People who are bullies.
They're bullies, and they're often really sort of emotionally explosive. And one tactic that these experts suggest for dealing with people who are just kind of ranting is to let them rant for a while. Just sit back and listen and give them space. And they often run down. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then you can eventually say in as mild-mannered a way as you can, okay, that's enough, or I think mm-hmm. I've heard you, or can you stop and be quiet for a minute, or something relatatively gentle, but we're not talking physical violence here. We're just sort of talking a verbal onslaught.
Right. I love that you quote the director of the Center for Creative Learning in Milwaukee, who explains how you know you've run into one of these people. You become emotionally hijacked by other
right.
people.
In other words, your emotions are running away with you, or the whole situation is running away with you. And so the solution is to kind of pause for a second, like a 30-second meditation, and just listen to yourself. Notice if your heart is racing or your palms are getting sweaty, and you know, recognize if you're getting anxious or angry, and calm yourself down for a second and then deal with the other person.
Judy Foreman is a nationally syndicated health columnist. For more on emotional intelligence, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
50 years ago last month, beat poet Allen Ginsberg stood up at the Six Gallery in San Francisco and read from a work in progress called Howl. The poem thrilled the audience and later came to define a generation of beat poets. Today, it is one of the most widely read poems of the 20th century, with nearly a million copies in print. Tonight in Cambridge, Massachusetts, people are marking the anniversary with a benefit reading of Howl. And joining us now, three poets who will be there tonight, poet and Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic Lloyd Schwartz. Welcome back, Lloyd.
Thank you.
Poets David Rivard. Hello, David.
Hello.
And Gail Mazur.
Thank you.
And Lloyd, how groundbreaking was it?
Well, it was amazing to have a truly serious and marvelously inventive poem that also incorporated some of what people consider very bad language. It was street language.
I think that Ginsberg, from an early age, really knew that he was going to be a public poet and that he was going to get attention for the things he was doing and his politics. So it's also really a political poem.
And when you read it, you hear this sort of onrushing, flooded syntax that is so utterly American it just couldn't be anything else.
There's also a myth that he wrote either on drugs or just with, you know, completely without revising. And we have, and there's a wonderful published version of the kind of Variorum edition of Howl that shows the, in fact, meticulous revising process that he went through. I mean, he did do some experiments over his career with, you know, writing on drugs or just automatic writing. But Howl was not one of those poems.
He was actually scholarly, and his idea of freedom might not be the street idea of freedom, although it was very popular in the streets. I mean, so he loved people to think that his first thought, best thought approach was really, you know, these were all automatic, spontaneous outpourings.
But
they're really controlled.
He also had an uphill fight. And I remember the first time I heard him read, he came to Queens College when I was an undergraduate. So this had to be like 1959 or 1960. And he read Howl, and some college student in the audience actually yelled out, "Hey, Ginsberg, why don't you read a real poem?"
Well, what was the effect on others? I mean, what
electrifying.
But at the time, there were some who thought, what is this?
Yeah, well, there's a very sort of famous, notorious piece by Diana Trilling, isn't it, where she talks about going to a reading by the beat poets, and she actually says, you know, they weren't dressed very well, but they didn't smell bad.
I mean, and he was a student of Lionel Trilling.
And he was a student of her husband.
And just before we move on from that, Lloyd, though, you said electrifying. I should ask, what was your feeling when you heard it?
Well, I was overwhelmed. I mean, I didn't know what to think. I was too immature as a reader or a listener to know what to think, but I know that I had been through something incredibly powerful and like nothing else I had ever heard before.
When I think of this poem, this is a very simplistic thing I'm about to say, but I think of the painting The Scream, because that's how it feels to me about, you know, people just howling and tearing at their brains. Yeah. But you, Lloyd, are saying that some of it's actually kind of funny to you.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things that I love about it, I mean, I think it's a tragic poem, ultimately, but he does have a wonderful sense of humor. It's one of my favorite lines in Howl, if I could read it. He's talking, this is in a series of descriptions of young people who are committing suicide, and there are different ways of committing suicide. And then there's this passage: who jumped off the Brooklyn Bridge, this actually happened, and walked away unknown and forgotten into the ghostly days of Chinatown soup alleyways and fire trucks, not even one free beer.
But again, suicide, so it's sort of a juxtaposition there.
Right.
And I know, David, you have a passage, too, that you like. Let's listen to that.
Yeah.
And why?
This is a little bit after the passage that Lloyd read. Who drove cross-country 72 hours to find out if I had a vision, or if you had a vision, or he had a vision to find out eternity. Who journeyed to Denver, who died in Denver, who came back to Denver and waited in vain, who watched over Denver and brooded and loaned in Denver and finally went away to find out the time, and now Denver is lonesome for her heroes, who fell on their knees in hopeless cathedrals praying for each other's salvation and light and breasts until the soul illuminated its hair for a second. I think, is, you know, in one sense for me, the poem's about a kind of redemption that is possible in this life only through experiencing as much as possible, being as alive as possible. And, you know, although I think Lloyd's right that it is a tragedy in some sense, I think it's also about a kind of commitment to experience.
We began with Ginsberg reading his own words. Now, those words just make my heart race. But Lloyd Schwartz, I'm wondering if, you know, however many years later, they still resonate with younger people. I'm going to just read a little bit from an excerpt that I found, a parody two Canadian writers put together. It's called Howl 2, eh? I see the best dressed of my generation, trendy, coked to the nose, hooked on Trivial Pursuit, driving their free-spirited BMWs through ghetto streets looking for the ideal cockroached flats to fix and flip. In other words, do you think younger people might see it as, you know, get over yourself?
Well, you know, that hasn't been my experience. The three of us teach young writers. And Ginsberg, at least in my experience, Ginsberg is one of the poets I can actually count on my students having read and been terrifically influenced by and are still excited about.
Fewer people. But I read, you know, a long part of this poem in class, and people were just totally silenced by it and loved it, you know? I mean, it spoke to them.
I just have to read a later line. Who are snapped, crackled, and popped for breakfast, Wonder Bread for lunch, TV dinner with supper, who saw Dick and Jane see Mom and Dad see spot poop on Sally and left it to Beaver.
I think they're longing for the life in Howl.
You know, it's so, speaks to a generational difference. That's, you know, in terms of the sort of ironicized.
I mean, you see how you would think, this is what we're stuck with.
We've been talking about beat poet Allen Ginsberg's Howl with poets Lloyd Schwartz, David Brevard, and Gail Mazur. The three of them are going to be part of a celebration of Ginsberg's works tonight at the Blacksmith House in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'll tell you all about it at here-now.org if you're in the area and can go. Otherwise, get thee to a book and take another look, perhaps, at Hal. Thank you all so much for joining us in the studio.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you, Robin. Thanks so much.
And for those who can't either get to a bookstore or to the reading tonight, here's a little more of Allen Ginsberg at a reading in Chicago in 1959.
Storefront burrows of tea head, joyride neon, blinking traffic light, sun and moon and tree vibrations in the roaring winter dusks of Brooklyn, ash can rantings and kind King, light of mind, who chained themselves to subways for the endless ride from Battery to Holy Bronx on Benzedrine until the noise of wheels and children brought them down shuddering, mouth-racked and battered, reek of brain all drained of brilliance in the drear light of zoo.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.